This is On the Other Hand.
A podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community members who are working with others across the political divide. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, part of a national organization that aims to reduce political polarization by promoting honest and respectful dialogue among people of all political beliefs. We are continuing our conversation today about political polarization with Jerry Henderson. Today, we're going to be hearing more about the causes of polarization and also get into what influences the levels of toxic polarization in our society. Well, Jerry, as we continue our conversation about political polarization and what the research has to say about things, I wanted to add a couple of things. We were talking about causes of polarization and things that contribute to extreme political polarization. One of the other things I've heard about is the fact that America is becoming a more diverse society in recent years. We're having a lot more people with different ethnicities, different ways of thinking about things, just a lot of diversity that we haven't always had in the history of our country, although I suppose you could argue we have. They just looked a little differently than they do now. At any rate, that point, some people have said that as you get a more diverse society, you have many more pockets of beliefs and subcultures that look at things differently. And so those differences almost guarantee less agreement overall as a society and as a culture. So that could be one of the things contributing to it.
Well, and another issue surrounding that is, you know, how people feel about immigration and becoming more diverse. And that's a trigger for some.
Yeah, that's true. Some people really are fearful of immigration changing their way of life. But that actually has been happening throughout our country.
You know, right.
What was 100 years or whatever when the big uproar about immigration was because the Irish were coming or the Italians were coming.
So yes.
It's something like that all the time. But it's also true that immigration has been a great source of strength. And with that diversity coming in from other countries, it's brought a lot of people who are very knowledgeable, very industrious, and contribute greatly to the welfare of our country. So hopefully that'll continue to be the case. There was another thing that I was going to bring up. As a psychologist, you certainly are aware of the importance we attribute to stress in overall health mm-hmm. and illness. Now, we think of that in terms of individuals. There's a huge body of persistent research for decades that has clearly shown that stress levels and people's ability to manage that stress make a big difference in terms of the outcome of illnesses. And interestingly, that's true for both traditional physical or medical illnesses as well as mental illness. Both of them, their outcomes are in part determined by the level of stress a person experiences. Now, I'm bringing that up because there are some things going on throughout a country's history, like economic downturns. Those are stressors for the system.
Certainly, yeah.
Right now we've got the pandemic, the COVID pandemic that has been going on for 3+ years now, I believe. And so that's another stressor. But that's a stressor to the system. So one might wonder, is what's true for the individual, is that also true for groups of people or entire country or system? There's a body of research that's pretty well developed that started with families, a system of families, people in a family. I won't go into too much. It's called Expressed Emotion Research if anyone wants to Google it and look it up. But it basically says that in a family, if you have someone who's vulnerable, perhaps someone with a major mental illness, in that family, the atmosphere of the family can make a big difference in terms of the outcome of that person who is vulnerable and has the illness. Those families who have certain characteristics that are like characterized by high criticism, negativity, conflict, poor boundaries, either getting too close to family members or too distant, lots of frequent changes and things like that.
Yeah.
Those are known to be associated with poorer outcomes for that vulnerable individual. It's actually been shown to have increased rates of relapses of mental illness, longer times in the hospital, more severe symptoms. And then when they've actually had mental health professionals go in and teach the family ways to reduce those negative characteristics in the family environment, it has been shown to reduce the level of relapses and rehospitalizations and symptoms in that vulnerable individual.
Yeah.
Okay. And it kind of fits what we know about stress at the individual level, so we apply it then to that group level. So I'm just suggesting, there's no research that's looking specifically at that yet, but we are seeing more research looking at different systems other than families, that it's true that these kind of negative environments can be a problem for the people who are in that system. I think that makes sense to apply that to a nation as well. So that would suggest that when we have a lot of stresses going on in the nation, that the vulnerable persons in the country are more likely to deteriorate or decompensate or have some worsening problems of various types. So that's one of the things I thought was kind of interesting to look at, the impact of stressors on the country.
Well, I think a point could be made also about there seems to be little doubt that the pandemic has raised a considerable amount of polarizing energy for us.
So. Yeah, no doubt. Well, I tell you what, I just wanted to get those others out, but we're still talking about causes and influences on polarization. Let's get to something that I know you're quite familiar with. You've done a lot of work on this, and what I've heard has been fascinating. So begin to tell us a little bit about the role that evolution has played in terms of how it applies to our brain and how we make decisions and how that impacts our level of polarization.
Sure. Well, in my mind, it's difficult to appreciate the power of polarization without some understanding of the intense human need for group affiliation, and along with that, the powerful emotions that arise during competitive competition between groups. And we don't have to go far to see an example of that. Think how emotionally aroused we can get just watching our favorite sports team win or lose, and the emotions that go with losing by 1 point versus winning. So evolutionary psychologists argue that group loyalty and defense of group status historically in our evolutionary history bestowed significant survival value. So early humans involved in groups of approximately 50 to 200. They shared many resources such as food, they hunted together, protected one another from predators and other competitive groups. Consequently, an individual that was banished from the group because they aren't contributing adequately or they were disloyal faced an immediate survival threat.
They get kicked out of the tribe, then at the mercy of the wild animals.
Just small things like if you sleep at night and you don't have somebody awake to say, hey, predator's in the camp, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah, back then, we don't have to worry about that so much now in our civilized society,
right.
But that's a good point. So that we evolved in that environment.
Absolutely, yeah. So as a consequence, emotionally charged behavioral tendencies surrounding loyalty and defense of the group are woven deeply into our psychological and even our neurological makeup.
Well, that kind of makes sense when you think about it that way, because we know humans are social animals, and there are a lot of social animals, you know, bees, dolphins, primates, and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So I wonder if that would make sense that if it's something that we've evolved, there may be to a lesser degree something true with other animals.
Well, neuroscientists have suggested that the human brain is actually specialized for group functioning. Even the evolutionary development of human emotions was likely related to their survival value in coordinating human activity and facilitating group bonding and loyalty.
You may have to help me with that one, Jerry. Now, when I think about the development of human emotions, I'm thinking about the survival value of emotions being tied to the fight flight response, and you're saying there's also something that's group related. Can you help me flesh that out?
Well, the notion here is that in the very early stages of evolutionary history, that fight flight system, but as we were so early in our evolutionary system, probably before Homo sapiens, there was a development of human emotions to keep us survived, not just alert, but to bond us together into groups where we ended up, and the survival value of being in a group is pretty important.
So. Okay, I see. So kind of evolutionarily, early on, the individual fight, flight, survival instinct developed, and then as we became increasingly involved as group animals, then that evolution tended to incorporate the group nature of human beings into the role that emotions play with survival.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So as suggested above, privileging and defending groups we identify with is a universal human tendency. And once we become a member of a group, such as a political party, our social identity and our self-esteem become entangled with the status of the group. This entanglement of our partisan identity with self-esteem is a primary factor in the intense partisan animosity associated with threat to party status. So threats to our team from opposing parties not only generate strong emotions, it also can produce a physiological stress response as indicated by greater salivatory cortisol concentrations.
Oh, okay. See? So for those of you who don't know, cortisol is one of those chemicals in the body that's associated with the stress response. So you're saying then that when we form this group identity, we identify with this tribe or this sports team or this political party, then anytime someone attacks the group, it jeopardizes our own identity and arouses that stress response.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And along that line, being ostracized by group members produces a similar pattern of neuroactivation to that shown when a person is experiencing physical pain. So I think what this is getting at is that this notion of protecting the group, being a member of the group, runs very, very deep. So, people also show similar brain responses when they are sad themselves as when they observe a sad group member, but this does not hold for opposition members. So
that's interesting. So it's in a group, if one person in the group is sad, others develop that too? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, it's if you're a member of a group,
okay,
you observe, you know, this is going to be on video or something, you observe a group member that's sad, mm-hmm, you will have a different response if that's a member of your group than if it isn't.
Oh, probably like you feel more empathy or
right,
identify more with that person,
yeah,
in your group.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah,
I see.
Yeah.
That's helpful. Thank you.
It's also noteworthy that humans tend to work against their own interest if it will result in the defeat of an opposing group. So there appears to be a primal human motivation to defeat opposing groups, even when it works against the greater good. And I think we can agree this is probably entirely consistent with politicians who decide to obstruct bills that might be in the interest of their constituents or even the nation as a whole, just to block the other party from having a win.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
That helps us explain some of the things we might not otherwise have a clue as to how people are,
yeah,
making their decisions. Huh. Okay. I'm having to wrap my brain around that a little bit. But if it reminds me that sometimes evolution does a good job for what's happening early in evolution, but it persists for a long time in humans and becomes less helpful. So, like, for instance, the stress response for survival was great back when we lived in the primitive things, but now, you know, most mental health professionals are well aware that the stress response is aroused by a lot of things that aren't truly dangerous, and yet it keeps coming up and it produces problems with anxiety, for instance.
And it's not our friend.
Yeah, right. Okay, so it sounds like that's another example of that, where that group identity and attacking opposing groups may have outlived its usefulness, or at least it certainly leads to sometimes when it's not helpful.
You know, and the upshot of this is it's not just about affinity to join a group. This research suggests we have a great affinity to defeating them.
Yeah.
You know, so it may extend back to our evolutionary history when there were competing groups for food in a valley or something, and the groups, when there was a drought, they had to work that out, and it probably wasn't very fun.
Oh, okay.
So these powerful primitive psychological forces contribute to the primal nature of intergroup dynamics that develop between competing groups. So we need to keep in mind that we're wired to protect the status of our group, and we're wired to defeat opposing groups. So to the extent we can be aware and regulate these competitive impulses, and keep reminding ourselves that the person in the opposing party has human dreams and fears just like we do, and also they're an American.
Wow, that's really powerful. That's good stuff. So you're saying basically we have to be aware of some of these urges we have are not always helpful, and we have to be mindful of that and be willing to look at ourselves and act in ways that counter that kind of primitive urge that may not be so helpful in our modern society.
Pretty destructive, perhaps, in the political process.
Very good.
The social identity theory put forth by political scientists follows somewhat logically from the information from evolutionary psychology regarding the power of group affiliation. It also helped to explain the multitude of factors, very complex factors, that feed into political polarization. It's based on the evidence that our sense of self is largely derived from the groups we belong with and identify with, such as a political party. Once we become identified with a political party, we become motivated to protect and advance the party's dominance over competing parties and to defend and elevate our party's political position. So this is consistent with that ever-present need to be in a group, and once we're in a group, to defeat competing groups. So
okay.
From this model, what truly emerges from partisan social identity is the fact that failures and victories become personal, and again, as I mentioned earlier, entangled with our self-esteem. So research evidence indicates that a mega-identity can be formed through the merger of component identities, such as race, ethnicity, gender, and class.
Can you help me understand that a little more? Talk me through that, what that means.
Well, the more cleavages, as political science called them, in other words, the more vectors that we are common with the group, like, let's say, our race, our religion, our political party, even our socioeconomic class, they tend to create more powerful elements that we're talking about here, because the identity factors are lining up into what they call a mega identity. Now, if there's cross-cutting factors, political scientists say, then that will lessen that possibility. But think of how many values and other factors that today's conservatives and liberals line up on. So the more of those lines of conversion that you're on that side, I'm on this side, that tends to deepen the animosity and competitiveness, and this decision that we must defeat these people. They're very, very different than us.
And know? That's what it's about is differences. If you have, differences. As a group, the individual members of the group, the more they share a lot of different attributes that are the same,
exactly.
then that's what gives them an even greater, stronger adhesion to that group.
Right.
And then with that, because this other tendency, it also makes them more likely to have really strong kind of anti-other group tendencies.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. So how does that play up in terms, I think we've got some hints in there, but what does that say then about politics and political partisanship and the polarization from that?
Well, I think it's a causative factor in the whole heat of polarization, for one thing, and it just keeps the general competitive heat pretty high. So,
okay.
For example, we were talking about the commonalities that conservatives and liberals along various lines. There's talk about this kind of tendency for conservatives to live in rural areas and just they tend to be practicing Christians. They tend to have a nationalist view of the world. And in contrast, liberals often live in urban environments, tend to be more secular, and they're less wed to the land, so to speak. They're more willing to pull up and move to another city or another country if a better job comes up.
Yeah, they don't own 100 acres and have cattle.
Well, and their great-grandfather and their father weren't farmers.
Right, okay.
So, and if you think all the value differences that line up between conservatives and liberals these days, you have issues such as gun control, strong feelings on both sides, abortion, obviously strong feelings, and affirmative action. So there's a lot of policy issues that have a lot of motion wrapped around them. So partisanship is considered a particularly salient and powerful identifier for two reasons. First, it's acquired at a pretty young age, and consequently, it doesn't change much over the life cycle. You know, you hear of people changing from one party to the other, but that's relatively rare,
So brand loyalty, which
yes.
I know they've talked about that in terms of marketing and advertising
yeah.
research, that if you can get somebody early on to prefer a particular brand, they tend to stick with it.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing, I guess.
Pretty much, yes. And secondly, political campaigns recur frequently, so we are constantly receiving partisan cues from leaders, and these cues often have polarizing content.
So, yeah. Which means, we're right and the other group's wrong. We need to oppose them at all costs kind of thing. That's kind of the... What we don't realize is how much of that then is driven by kind of some deep, fairly primitive, evolutionarily derived instincts.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is we have to be truly motivated to monitor into that and see when it's raising its ugly head in a way that doesn't benefit us or other people.
Yeah, so monitoring oneself, self-assessment, that's a whole big topic. We probably should get into that at some point.
Okay. Well, so from this theory, voters are motivated, of course, to defend the party in order to maintain a positive standing, and this sort of underlines the tribal nature of politics. And it's a little surprising to me, but it fits with this theory that supporting notion that a recent study found that 41% of partisans agreed that simply winning elections was more important than any policy or ideological goal in getting them engaged in politics.
Wow. That's kind of scary. So
it is.
It seems to be totally divorced from any real thought-out values and preferences. It's more just about winning.
It's not completely divorced, I think, but... It's the preeminent concern, winning, as opposed to, I'm voting for this or that. I'm voting for my team or their team. So. So also, we talked about affective polarization yesterday as one of the terms used. And from the social identity perspective, affective polarization with its strong animosity toward the opposing party is kind of a natural offshoot of the partisan group identity. So
so all of this is contributing to the polarization that we're seeing in the country now.
Yeah. So what emerges from the research involving partisan social identity is that it is not the rational choice of policy and the ideological considerations, but rather our voting pattern is based on partisan group identity. This appears to account why politicians that encourage anger of the opposing party because it increases loyalty of the base. So merely generating anger in voters, the existing party gains points because loyalty goes up. Unfortunately, this also means that politicians appear to be learning that slogans and emotions can be more powerful than the information put out by a well-informed and skilled policy wonk. I don't think Hillary Clinton got that message.
She was relying too much on the intellectual,
rational. She was the type of politician that might have been able to do the job, but she couldn't get the job.
Yeah. I mean, okay. And of course, that depends on your viewpoint of what works in government. Like, you know, a lot of people will say, well, no, she's left-leaning, and that with that comes the whole, you know, casting them as socialist or communist or whatever it is. So, you know, if you're a conservative, you might rationalize, I would imagine, that, well, it's not about my emotion wanting my team to win. This person is really evil because they're sitting here describing what they want. It's bad for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, it sort of may fold into, there's a lot of rise in populist politicians across the world, and their basic theme is to appeal to emotion and tribe. So it works,
yeah,
unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
Well, what this really tells us is that if we want to reduce polarization, we certainly need to evaluate political candidates more through a rational and less through an emotional lens. If not, voting against our own interests can occur if we don't have some consideration of this. And you hear sometimes about people voting against their own interests, you know.
Yeah, and this fits really well with something that, you know, I think I'll be talking about later. It's an important point to me, and it's kind of the difference between emotional and rational. What you do when you're making decisions, when you're gathering information, which part of you is most in charge, the emotional or the rational? And you're suggesting we make better decisions if we keep the emotion at moderate levels and use more of the rational part.
Well, and also being alert when we're getting highly aroused in a political arena, where are we going with that? If we could stop and pause and ask ourselves, okay, man, I just got a surge of emotion. What's this for? Who gains from it? Is it in my best interest to get it under control, or should I just slide with it? And
Jerry, that's fascinating. And one of the reasons it is because, as you know, as a psychologist, we're trained in psychotherapy to pay attention to our own emotions that get aroused when we're working with a client.
Mm-hmm.
To not give into that emotion, but try to notice it and ask ourselves rationally, what is that about? Where's that coming from? What does that tell me about that person or about myself, so that
sure,
we can do the best job possible in therapy? You're saying, if I understand you right, you're saying the same thing, but in a different context. Instead of therapists doing that, you're talking about every voter trying to pay attention when they start getting real emotion, to be noticing, I'm getting emotional. What does that mean? What's yanking my chain? What's a good way to look at this? Let me slow down and think this through. Is what you're saying.
Right. So, I mean, we could put that in the context. How would a person like Vladimir Putin ever make his way up to just an absolute autocrat if he didn't know how to utilize emotion? Because he was very popular at times, 80% popularity. Mm-hmm. And now, there went your freedom. So, yeah. So evolutionary theory helps explain the intensity of tribal politics. And there's also emerging evidence that there is some divergence along the evolutionary path that differentiates conservatives from liberals.
Oh, this could be interesting. You're saying that there's a difference between the evolution or development of the liberals and conservatives. We'll have to hear more about that.
Yeah. Glenn, evolutionary psychologists have proposed a theory based on the differential exposure of early humans to infectious diseases. The parasite stress theory views people as having an inherited, parasitically modified behavioral tendency aimed at avoiding those humans that bring the greatest risk of infection and transmitted disease into one's social group. So the basic point there is, probably in those early evolutionary groups, if one member of the tribe went over and mixed it up with the tribe over the hill over there, and their local immunity didn't cover the parasite that they brought back into the tribe, then it could wipe the whole tribe out.
Oh.
So there's what we'll see as this develops is that conservative angle of threat assessment would suggest that conservatives somewhere along the line as a group may have been exposed to greater infectious diseases over a chronic period of time.
Jared, could it be a different, you talk about as if we had conservatives and liberals divided up early in prehistory, and I wonder if it could be looked at in a different way, that it was just humans develop these tendencies, but there's always some variation in any population. So if you have some people who have more higher levels of that threat assessment instinct from the evolutionarily derived parasitic theory-based kind of mm-hmm. thing compared to others, then they would naturally divide into one's more likely to be thinking in a conservative fashion other than a liberal. That's what I'm hearing, but maybe I've got it.
Well, the researchers in the theory are really suggesting that environments where over the long, millennia, that there was greater parasitic transmission, that those people either had to deal with that by developing, and we'll see how this is connected, a strong disgust response to people that appear sick. If they didn't do that, they perished. And so in one sense, I'm not saying that we were conservatives or liberals back then, but those that were able to develop that disgust response protected them to a degree against, they alerted quicker to people coming into the group. They were more afraid of strangers
mm-hmm.
In that sense. I mean, that's the theory.
Okay, so the theory is that people in general develop that, but maybe some groups more so than others. So not everybody had that.
If you were on an island when there were no other people but your group and there were no parasites to deal with, you wouldn't have went there in your evolutionary history.
Okay.
You wouldn't have needed to.
Oh, okay.
So you would have been, like liberals, more open to exploring new things.
Huh. Okay.
So,
when we hear liberal conservative, my concern is that people listening may be thinking politics, but here we're actually talking pre-politics.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, these people aren't theorizing, so much about some of these people are not even they're biologists. They're not politicians or political scientists.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, thank you.
So, in other words, parasitic stress may enhance the fear response to outgroups and the loyalty required for in-groups to make it in it. So if a group, tribal group, back in our evolutionary history knew that over the hill they were dying like flies over there, and then we found out one of our members went over there, visited, and now they're wanting to come back.
Sorry, you don't belong in the group.
You didn't maintain your loyalty to the group, and you make us all expire, you know. So
okay, so you're no longer in the group. You're fired.
Yeah. And that kind of hits with the moral foundations theory of purity and sanctity.
That's okay. Now that's a new idea. You're going to have to help us out there.
Well, the purity and the non-mixing and the sanctity is part of that loyalty to the group in this model.
Okay. Well, but let me point out that so you're talking about the moral foundations research that Jonathan Haidt has talked about, and he's highlighted that. So according to that, I think that theory says there are a number of moral foundations. There are ways of looking at the world and making moral judgments. And there the research has identified some differences between, you know, the average conservative and the average liberal in terms of what motivates their moral decision making. Is that a reasonable summary?
And, you know, he says that he believes his moral foundations theory is based on our evolutionary history.
Right. Okay.
So there, in this theory, there was a lot of human emotion developing around survivability in a parasite-threatened environment. And one of the concepts they use is the behavioral immune system, which works through a basic instinct to avoid contamination by experience of disgust from disease-laden cues people may harbor with infectious agents.
Now,
that's a mouthful.
It is. Now, I want to, because I was familiar with the behavioral immune system notion, but I got something different out of it. My kind of fairly simplistic notion was that in the same way that our body has developed an immune system that recognizes foreign agents such as bacteria and so on and rallies its defenses against it and tries to kill it, that the behavioral immune system notion was that our brain in a similar way has evolved to have a tendency to respond to foreign or new ideas that don't fit with our ideas or our group's ideas, and to reject that out of hand and to combat against that. That was kind of the way I was looking at it. Is how close am I?
Well, I think those terms can be used in metaphorically, but in the parasite stress theory, it's considered a evolutionary driven. That if you didn't develop the behavioral immune system that enhanced your threat assessment, enhanced your disgust response, you didn't survive.
Because you didn't have the strong need to avoid the other group or avoid something that was different in there. Yeah, okay.
And we could hypothesize that if someone from that island where they didn't have parasitic stress to worry about, if they came into this other environment, they would probably change and become more conservative.
Okay. Yeah. All right. It sounds like there was a subsequent idea. I know one psychologist talked about that behavioral immune system in reference to the brain and the way we think about our belief formations. Okay.
So one of the things that the behavior immune system fits in ways is investigators report disgust sensitivity, especially for contamination, disgust for violation of sense of purity. So there are some commonalities that emerge here, and of course these researchers are looking, how does this fit with that, how does this fit with that, you know, other body of research. So
if I can summarize in my mind, it's that the disgust development, that primitive disgust emotion, it was developed because it was very protective of the survival of the group by not getting sick from some other group's bad,
absolutely,
you know, biological stuff, but in a similar way that may at some point generalize to non-biological factors.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, yeah.
So that we experience disgust when we hear an idea that's foreign to what we think is right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And reject it out of hand.
Sure.
So it's similar. Okay.
Sure.
All right. Very good.
So I previously mentioned moral foundations theory, and social psychologists have proposed this theory that's also a source of evolutionary derived basis for moral behavior, and it has consequences for the conservative liberal axis. The theory posits that moral instincts evolve to generate rapid, intuitive moral judgments such as care harm, fairness cheating, loyalty betrayal, authority subversion, and purity disgust.
And I'll jump in there and say that's if you read The Righteous Mind, which is the book that Jonathan Haidt wrote that covers this pretty well, you'll see what he's talking about. But he's basically saying that's the current view of research on moral foundations, is that these are the key things that people are looking at when they're making decisions based on their morality.
Yeah, yeah. So from the theorizing, those in very conservative emphasize loyalty to the in-group, you know, submission to authority or importance of authority and order, and a sense of purity, whereas those liberal emphasize minimizing harm and maximizing fairness. And so do the conservatives value those. It's just that the liberals value the other ones less.
Okay. They from what I'm aware of, the conservatives tend to have all of those that are important.
All
the liberals
five,
have just, you know, a couple that they place greater view on. And it's not that they have no concern for the others, but they have
no
concern
right.
for conservatives.
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
So this research suggests that the evolutionary history gave rise to moral intuitions that strongly bind humans into group, but also blinds them to the differing values of opposing groups. So, you know, Haidt also come up with this notion that intense partisanship between liberals and conservatives is related to the differences in their deepest moral convictions.
So. Yeah, that's really important, I think, because it's basically saying if this is true, then when you're in one group and you're kind of tending to oppose the other group because they're another group, and that's what your evolutionary history says you should do, is that it also induces a set of blindness that you think, I'm right because I have these moral values that I know are right for the group, but you fail to appreciate that the other group has some moral values as well. You're just not seeing it.
Yeah.
Which sounds like dehumanizing in a sense.
It opens the door for it. Huh?
Yeah, okay. Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed this part of our discussion on polarization with Jerry Henderson. Be sure to check out the rest of our conversation and future podcast episodes of On the Other Hand on the Braver Angels Arkansas website. That address is arkansas.braverangels.org, and you just go to the podcast page from there. We'd like to hear from our listeners. We'd like to know what feedback you have for us, what you like about our program, any suggestions you have for improvement, especially any ideas for speakers or topics that you'd like to see us covered. But basically, whatever you want to share with us, all you got to do is email it to us. So if you go to the Braver Angels Arkansas website on the podcast page, you will find a link to send us a Gmail, and that email address is otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band. Dr. Richard Main, the conductor. From your host, Glenn White, have a good evening, and let's keep the conversation going as we work to bring our community closer together.